seat so we can resume our meeting. Okay, Mr. Briggs, so we're ready for staff to
correct
give us their comments and response to what they've heard.
We just had a speed meeting.
Okay.
And so we have Monica Baracarte, who we introduced earlier at the front table, Matthew Keeling, and Lisa McCann. Angela will be joining us in a minute. And I think we will hear a little bit from Jill North, who is seated directly behind Ms. McCann briefly. So we try to make notes of things that seem like they could benefit from clarification, responses, and that sort of thing. Certainly not everything. That would take a long time, considering all the comments we've received over a great long period of time. So we will try to hit the important points. Angela, are you leading off?
I am.
All right.
With me.
And of course, you're the last one to sit there.
And who is this gentleman with? I'm just curious.
Channel 12.
Channel 12. Okay.
Also, as Angela's still getting squared away here, I'll point out that we're going to make our way around the horn eventually, with Michael having a few comments with a couple slides that go with it, and then me.
Okay.
To tail in.
Good afternoon, Chairman Young, members of the board. My name is Angela Schroeder.
Oh, yeah,
closer here?
There
yeah,
you go.
Closer.
My name is Angela Schroeder, and I'm a senior engineering, Schroeder, S-C-H, there are names. Senior engineering geologist and program manager for the Agricultural Regulatory Program. Before I begin, I just wanted to thank you all for taking the time. It's been a really long day, really long process, and your contribution's not insignificant. So as Roger mentioned, I'm going to provide you with a brief summary of key public comment areas, staff's response to the issues brought up, and some changes to the draft order that staff is recommending based upon testimony heard on March 17th, as well as testimony heard at the continuation today. You will also hear from individual staff who worked on specific areas of the draft order, and they'll respond to some of the technical issues. Finally, Michael Thomas and Roger Briggs will conclude and make the final staff recommendation. So the board has provided significant opportunities for public input to the draft order. Staff has publicly released three versions and continues to recommend changes that are responsive to many of the issues raised. At the March 17th board meeting and again today, we heard additional testimony that was reflective of the major public comment areas the board has heard throughout the process. Sorry. The board has heard from individuals about the significant impacts from nitrate loading to groundwater and agricultural wells, as well as impacts to public drinking water supplies and private domestic wells. The board has heard from individuals, communities, schools, and environmental justice organizations who are impacted by agricultural discharges that protecting drinking water should be among our highest priorities. The board has also heard comments that agriculture must be accountable for the associated impacts to water quality, similar to any other individual business or industry, and that the data should be made available to the public about the impairment caused by agricultural discharges.
Hold on a little bit.
We've also heard that the order should not be one size fits all, and not all farms cause the same level of water quality impairment. One example of that is testimony heard from the Strawberry Commission on March 17th that strawberry should be considered low risk to water quality. We've also heard about costs and economic issues, both from the perspective of the farmer, as well as cost to those affected by the pollution in agricultural areas. In addition, the Farm Bureau has presented an agricultural industry proposal to regulate dischargers, which is based upon the third-party coalitions. Throughout the process and also today, we've also heard some specific comments on the draft order. For example, we've heard comments that the order should tier based upon individual farms instead of operations. We've heard that acreage is an inappropriate tiering criteria. We've also heard that the order should include additional pesticides like pyrethroids and others rather than just chlorpyrifos and diazinon. We've also heard that the order should allow the use of the University of California's nitrate hazard index, including the soil type. And finally, we've also heard that the executive officer should not have the authority to modify the tiering criteria. Now, to address these public comment areas, individual technical staff who worked on the specific areas of the draft order will respond to some of the technical issues. Before we do that, I wanted to just clarify some issues we've just heard on from some of the speakers today quickly. And that, for example, the issue of ponds and lining came up. And I just wanted to clarify that there is no requirement in the draft order to line ponds. There is a requirement that any ponds or retention basins must be monitored as part of the MRP, but there's no requirement that ponds must be lined. I also wanted to clarify part of the criteria and the issues brought up about whether or not a farm actually drains to a water body and how that someone could end up in tier three and not even discharge to a surface water body. And that change was made in the March 2011 draft, and that criteria is now clarified to say drains to an impaired water body, and I'll show that in the slides. So that should take care of that comment too. Tile drains, I wanted to bring that up briefly because Mr. Jeffries asked a question. Tile drains don't have any other additional requirements than the rest of those types of discharges in the order. So we'll bring up some. So Jill North is going to present a response based upon the food safety issues.
Thanks. I'm Jill North. I'm an environmental scientist here at the Regional Water Quality Control Board. And I just wanted to, a couple of the speakers that addressed us mentioned that we had conflicts with the LGMA metrics. And I just want to mention I've been working with food safety and water quality and promoting co-management since before the 2006 outbreak. And working with the LGMA and providing comments, and they've been very responsive to our comments. And they are not in conflict with any of our buffer requirements that we have. They do not state anywhere to remove vegetation in the LGMA metrics. And I just want to say for the record that
what do
no
they
conflict.
Require?
Excuse me?
What do they require?
They have buffers that are set. So they have set distances from, say, confined animal units or from cattle operations. So there may be some 30-foot buffers for the, I know that's the one for the cattle, but they don't require vegetation removal at all. And they also have a specific statement within the metrics that you need to adhere to local, state, and federal environmental regulations. And they specifically call out any regulations for riparian protection and habitat protections. That's in the, it's, anyway. And then also,
Before you go on, Jill, mm-hmm. did that make sense to the board? The requirements are that they comply with state and federal regulations to protect habitat.
Well, I understand that, yeah. And how many pages, this is the, you call it the, is it the green leafy marketing order?
Leafy green marketing agreement.
Leafy green, okay. How many pages does that make up?
Oh, I don't, it's about that thick, 80, I'm guessing.
That much?
Yeah. They have a lot of different, they're looking at flooding and water and farm practices and
okay.
And animal entry.
Is that in a finalized form?
Yeah, they continually edit it and will update it based on public comment. But, yeah, it's in their most final form is available online.
Okay.
Just, Jill, one question.
Yes.
LGA, can you say what that is for people that don't know?
Leafy Green Marketing Agreement.
Thank you.
And then there have also been comments about the FDA, and I just want to say that the FDA, that the Federal Modernization Act that was passed in January 2011, that has written into the law that we will take into consideration environmental practices and also wildlife habitat, right, written into that law. And the FDA is also working. They have a special panel convened with that EPA and NRCS is working with. And I've participated in the Farm Food Safety Coalition Network that has also worked with FDA and agriculture to address the food safety and water quality issues and to promote co-management. And we support, NRCS has a document, and our order refers to it as well. And it has a document that looks at water quality and food safety practices and how you can bring environmental conservation practices into practice along with the food safety practices. So we also work with them to help develop that. And so the group, that panel that with the EPA and NRCS is working with the FDA because they also want to promote environmental practices and environmental safety in addition to the food safety. So that is coming down the line. And one gentleman talked about it, that it would be coming up pretty soon here. And the other thing I'd like to address is that Mr. Quant had some acreages, estimated acreages lost to the 30-foot buffers of almost 7,000 acres. And if I just want to explain that that only applies to a subset of Tier 3. And if they did choose to go with the 30-foot buffer, it would only affect 83 acres total. So all of his calculations and finances that went along with the 7,000 acres are not correct. And that's all I have to say.
Folks, please don't comment by mumbling and whatever you're doing. This isn't an event. Listen, the issue I raised about what Mr. Quant had put up there, and I'll just say this, is that he was making an assumption that, everything was going to be removed from the buffer. And he had numbers attached to it. And, my questions, showed that that wasn't true. So, to what extent then, do you accept everything that's in his presentation on those tables? I mean, it just leaves some doubt as to what is good and what isn't. And, if you want to just take, the worst case scenario and all of these situations and proposals and events, it's going to skew things such that it does not help us. So I'm not surprised that there might be something else in there that is a little bit inaccurate. I wish it would have been looked at a little more carefully before he presented it to us. Continue.
That's all I have to say.
Okay.
I just wanted to clarify one other item about on top of what Jill said about the buffer requirement. My name is Lisa McCann, M-C-C-A-N-N, Environmental Program Manager. That also, the water quality buffer plan requirement is for the purpose of controlling sediment discharges, and there's the order provides an alternative if the discharges can be controlled by protecting the bare soil and other erodible areas that are impacting the adjacent water bodies that are impaired for sediment, turbidity, or temperature.
Okay,
So that brings us to Matt Keeling.
Matthew Keeling, K-E-E-L-I-N-G. I'm a water resource control engineer on staff here. I was brought into the Ag Water Renewal Process as a groundwater quality expert, and I'm the primary author on the groundwater quality conditions report contained in Appendix G of the proposed order. I'm just going to speak briefly to you regarding some of the comments that we've heard back in March and today regarding our assessment of the nitrate loading and the water quality impacts that we used as the basis for our findings for this order. Now, we've heard public testimony indicating nitrate impacts may be more severe in some areas than we previously thought. We've also heard testimony claiming we've either inflated the significance of the nitrate loading that's associated with irrigated agriculture and the resulting water quality impacts, or have otherwise been wrong in our interpretation of available information. I can't emphasize enough how widespread and severe the nitrate impacts are to groundwater and drinking water supplies in our region. There's really nothing else in our region to compare it to, not even seawater intrusion, Los Osos, the Olin perchloric case, and Guadalupe oil field all combined. Simply put, nitrate contaminates more drinking water supply wells than any other contaminant or group of contaminants in our region and within the state. Now, although there are other sources of nitrate loading to groundwater that are locally irrelevant, like septic systems, wastewater treatment plants, dairies, gentlemen brought up poultry facilities, irrigated agriculture is by far the primary source of loading on a watershed or a regional basis. Now, land use, water use, nitrogen isotope studies, fertilizer sales data all point to this fact, along with water quality data documenting the most severe nitrate impacts within areas subject to intensive irrigated agricultural land use. We've also heard testimony claiming that the impacts are a result of legacy nitrate and that current loading is either inconsequential or not occurring. Legacy nitrate is real and it's significant. We acknowledge that. In many areas, the nitrate being detected in wells today is clearly from nitrate loading that occurred decades ago. However, relatively recent groundwater age dating studies, fertilizer and irrigation efficiency studies, nitrogen balance and uptake ratios, I mean, we do have some of that data available to us. And shallow groundwater data indicate nitrate loading is ongoing and is significant from irrigated agriculture. Now, nitrate loading that is occurring today will be the legacy nitrate that shows up in our drinking water supplies in years and decades to come. I also want to speak to, there's a comment made by a woman, and I think Jeff Young, you, Chairman Young, you questioned it, was regarding the Monterey County Water Resource Agency's nitrate programs. Now, back in 1997, the Monterey County Water Resource Agency, they put together a, let me look at my notes here real quick. It was a Nitrate Technical Advisory Committee, and they basically produced a draft document, and it was their Nitrate Management Plan Program document. And it had a bunch of elements in it. And it was a five-year plan, and they haven't completed all the elements of the plan. Most of the elements of the plan were primarily focused on water quality monitoring, source reduction outreach, education and research, and then they also had elements of kind of a groundwater protection program where they went out and they tried to do outreach with domestic well owners and individual well owners and trying to alert them to the risks of having wells in agricultural areas and what they could do to, you know, be educated about those risks. The effectiveness of those programs, we really have no idea because they have not been tracking them, and they've all been voluntary. if we look at what the Water Resource Agency has done with regard to irrigation efficiency, I think they deserve significant kudos. They've done a lot of work in working with the growers in Monterey County to improve irrigation efficiency. And I think if we can't set that aside from nitrogen loading, because the loading is primarily affected by irrigation efficiency as well as fertilizer application efficiency. So there is the likelihood that their irrigation efficiency programs have resulted in, you know, potential improvements in reducing nitrogen loading to groundwater. But we do not have any information or data that's been tracked that shows that is the case.
Well, we do. They did submit data to us.
They've submitted data to us that is somewhat censured. They're in a bit of a difficult position. When they've gone out and they've had something about 390 agricultural wells that are available to them to sample, and they've got voluntary agreements to access and sample those wells. As part of those agreements, they've agreed to keep the well information, the location information, confidential. And so the data that we get is a 30,000-foot elevation view of what the groundwater conditions look like on a map. We can't pinpoint where the wells are, where the hot spots are, within a township, or not even with a township range section basis at this point. We could probably work that out from them, but what we really wanted to get was individual well data. But the problem was that if they gave that to us, their monitoring program would basically dissolve overnight. Nobody would let them on site if they shared the well location information with us.
Can you, is there any trend that can be picked up from data that's reported that way?
Well, the two most recent sampling events that they've conducted, there's one in 1993, and the most recent was 2007. Overall, it looks like there's an increase.
An increase?
An increase. The problem with that is it needs to be qualified, because the wells that they sampled in 1993, the location and the number of the wells, is not the same as the number and the location of wells that were sampled in 2007. So you can't really make a comparison. What they have done is they've taken individual wells that they have sampled several times over the last 15, 20 years, and they've done trend analyses on those. Some of those wells show decreases. Some show increases. Overall, if you compare the 1993 and the 2007 data sets, the average concentrations have increased, and the number of wells that exceed the drinking water standard has increased. But again, it's difficult to make that comparison and definitively say that there has been an increase, because they're not the same wells.
It's a gross comparison.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Now, we've also heard testimony regarding whether monitoring requirements for agricultural supply wells is appropriate, and you very pointedly, Mr. Chairman, asked questions about that, trying to get feedback from some of the people giving testimony. And in case we have any doubts regarding this issue, there's essentially three reasons why water quality monitoring for agricultural supply wells is important. First, growers should be sampling irrigation water for nitrate and counting for it during irrigation to reduce the amount of additional fertilizer that they're applying to their crops. Available water quality data that we have indicate there are agricultural supply wells in our region that contain nitrate at concentrations at up to 15 times the drinking water standard. This nitrogen is available for crop uptake. Accounting for the available nitrate in irrigation water may be one of the most effective ways and immediate ways that we have in reducing nitrogen loading to our groundwater basins in our region. So you just think about, you know, if they can eliminate applying a certain amount of fertilizer and using what's already in the groundwater, that's an off-the-top reduction in the amount of applied nitrogen. Secondly, we really need to start collecting water data from these wells now, so that we have a baseline that we can use in the future to compare to and do trend analyses, such that we can see whether we've actually made improvements, if the ag order or other measures that we've implemented over time have been affected. This also speaks to the problem that we have with getting the Monterey County Water Resource Agency data. we need to start collecting our own data, because we cannot get the well data from the agencies that have it. And lastly, we need these data to help us prioritize implementation of the ag order and to protect our drinking water supplies. And these data are necessary to identify drinking water supply wells that may be at risk of nitrate impacts, and to better understand the source of potential problems, whether it be permeable soils, improperly constructed or damaged wells, fertigation systems that don't have adequate backflow prevention. Now, if an individual well or groups of wells within a certain area, you know, contain nitrate at 10 times the drinking water standard, we should be asking ourselves why and try to figure that out and to prioritize our efforts to look at those areas.
What if it's legacy nitrate?
In many cases, it will be, and that's something that we'll have to determine. You know, we go in and look at the well and the depths of the well and the areas, and that may very well be the case, but I think it warrants an additional investigation to rule out the other possibilities that there is continued loading or impacts that are associated with some problem that can be easily fixed.
So what would you be looking at? The data that it comes in from the irrigation and nutrient management plan, but that's only tier three.
Yeah.
As you're proposing.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we could check is to look at and see, you know, have they provided information regarding backflow prevention for fertigation to make that as, you know, kind of a higher order level of our review of what information is provided to us in that database.
That seems to be, that doesn't seem to be as obvious to me as the statement made by the gentleman, and I forget who it is right now, that you have to over-fertilize, that at least from the crops that he had studied, you know, the plant uptake is just not that efficient. Yeah, I think
he looked at
cotton.
Yeah.
That was the cotton example, so yeah. I'm just kind of...
I suggest you look at this in a different way. Plants uptake nitrogen very efficiently. Plants are very efficient. It's how we grow them is not necessarily efficient. It's inefficiencies in the irrigation management and the fertilizer application and the timing. You know, you try to plant the maximum amount of crops in an acre of land, and you want to grow it as fast as you can and turn around and bring it to market, it becomes difficult. You know, the efficiencies start to kind of fall away. Now, this is my own kind of big picture perspective. I'm not an agronomist, but you know, I've been looking at a lot of this stuff for a couple years now, and improvements can be made to reduce the loading. Whether or not we can reduce that to zero, at this point, I don't think so. But I don't think we should have a short-sighted approach and say, well, we shouldn't. Why should we try? Because we'll never get there. I think we should try to see how close we can get to that bar. And as we get to that point, we may learn lessons that enable us to improve our technology.
To answer your question more directly, Mr. Young, a few of the things that we would look at immediately in those cases were what practices were being reported in terms of the general nutrient management. For example, Tier 2 has annual compliance forms similar to the management practice checklist that's already required. We'd be looking at what practices are being reported there. For those individual farms which had a high nitrate loading risk, we would also be looking at total nitrogen applied.
Can you repeat that last phrase?
Total nitrogen applied.
Okay. Well, I think most farmers are probably willing to cooperate and make improvements in what they're doing. I think that there's probably a generalized fear that, you know, anything that they may do that gets reported to us is going to end up with administrative civil penalties being assessed against them. So, you know, at what point down the line, I don't know, what am I looking for? Is, you know, what is compliance? And what can be said to those that are, you know, kind of fearful for... Yes?
I was waiting for you to finish your sentence.
There's, I think, a fear of participating and providing information, and because, you know, the more you give a regulatory agency, the more it's going to end up biting back at us. And, I mean, I understand our approach because we are a regulatory agency, and that is how we operate, and there is some coercive effect in how the statutes and regulations are set up for us to seek, you know, compliance. But, you know, this is kind of a very unique program we're trying to implement, and I'm just trying to get a sense for, you know, where this transition lies between collecting information, analyzing, seeing what's going on, and then when the shoe drops. And
Ms. Chairman?
Yes.
Ryder, did you want to go?
Yeah, I was going to point out, if the board, you're talking as if you're going to be adopting something and losing control of enforcement in terms of follow-up, and this is the kind of thing that would come back to you. People are concerned about mandatory minimum penalties with the NPDES permitting program. This is not that situation. And it's not like you're giving up your control over enforcement, throwing it into a penalty machine or something, and it's going to run wild. You are the ones who would be making those decisions. And the case that the gentleman mentioned from the North County, that was a decision the board made based on the facts. Mm-hmm. Actually, the staff had recommended a much lower penalty. It came to the board. That's your decision. So it's not something where you're abdicating authority and it's going to throw people to some wolf in the closet. These are the things that come back to you. We would follow up with escalated enforcement actions of an administrative nature, but when you're talking about penalties, that's something that would come back to you.
I'm sorry, I got us off topic there.
I was just going to add that to what Roger's talking about, the process that we go through. There's a two-level process, there's a staff-level process, and then the board's process. And every day, staff is dealing with enforcement issues or potential enforcement issues. We're doing that right now with the ag program, where we have individuals where we have sent out notices of violation. They then contact us and talk to us about the situation, their particular situation, and we work with them on that. And then we decide in some cases, where they're the more egregious cases, where a person just ignored it or refuses to do it, those are the kind of cases we elevate to the board. The others go away or are settled. And then when those cases go to the board, then the board decides whether they're going to take an action. It will be the same thing in this case. The same thing that's going on with the existing ag order that was adopted in 2004 will be going on with the new order. That same two-level process, and at the staff level will be prioritizing and considering the circumstances of each case and those that warrant actual enforcement action or actual recommendations to the board for enforcement. There, as Roger pointed out, there is no mandatory minimum penalty type of situation in this case. It doesn't exist.
Okay. Continue. They took you off?
Okay.
All right.
Next, you'll hear from Monica Baracardi. Oops.
Good afternoon. Hi, I'm Monica Baricarte, Barricarte. I've been here with the Water Board for about 3 years now, and I am the person that is going to provide and present our response, staff response, to the issues raised by the Strawberry Commission during the last meeting we had in Watsonville, March 17. And I am the person bringing the response today because I was the staff assigned to prepare all the requirements of a nutrient management plan and that we talk about today many times, along with my colleague, Dean Thomas, that is a hydrogeologist. Both of us gather a small group of experts, a technical advisory committee that provided us input on the milestones and targets on the nitrogen ratios and balances that were raised today. The TAC, the small group that we gathered, was formed by experts from the University of California Cooperative Extension. They have experience with the fertility and with the fertilizers application of the crops raised that are grown on the Central Coast. We also have a certified crop advisor that has experience in the implementation of nutrient management plans for vineyards, and a certified crop advisor with experience in nutrient management plans with vegetables. And also we had a colleague from the Central Valley who has experience in the development of the nutrient management plans for the dairy program. And he also works for the ag program in the Central Valley. And he's the one who actually provided input on how much reporting can staff handle and how much we can actually evaluate. And that's why you see there that as part of the nutrient management plan, we only require key elements to be reported to us. I also work on this section of the order and the best management practices because I have experience with when I work with the resource conservation district in the Santa Maria area. I was one of the two people running what is called the irrigation mobile lab. I did that for about 7 years, and I had a chance to work with many strawberry growers then. And I also am a certified crop advisor. I've been certified for about 2 years. So if you remember, during the March 17 meeting, the Strawberry Commission was presenting preliminary information of a study that was suggesting the strawberries should be considered low risk, a crop with low risk for the potential of nitrogen leaching to groundwater. And they concluded that based on that saying that the majority of the acreage were managed in a manner that minimizes the nitrogen loading to groundwater. We staff here, our response is that we actually do not agree with that. We disagree with those conclusions, and there are two reasons for that.